Shao. I am the executive director here at GTI. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated to Taiwan policy research and analysis. Our mission is to enhance the U.S.-Taiwan relationship through public education. Towards that end, we undertake several major programs that include a weekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief, where we invite leading and emerging experts on Taiwan to contribute timely articles. We also have a seminar series that you are all participating in today, where we invite practitioners as well as scholars focused on Taiwan or Greater China to focus on current developments related to policy issues that affect the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. Coming up very shortly, we will be hosting our inaugural annual symposium on September 14th. And this is going to be our flagship event. We're expecting a large turnout of people within government, as well as academia and think tank experts who are interested in Taiwan. The purpose of the annual symposium is to establish a baseline on how we assess the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. And so if you're not already registered, please do so on our website. Last but not least, we also have a fellowship program where we encourage Taiwanese as well as American scholars who are interested to conduct field research in Taiwan and respectively for Taiwanese scholars to come here to the United States to do research related to the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. Before I begin today's program, I'd also like to acknowledge some of the important guests that we have in the room. They include our counselors, Dr. David Tsai, Dr. Chen Wenyan, to also include our advisor, one of our advisors, Richard Fisher, who is in the audience here today. And last but not least, our very important staff members at GTI who make all our programs possible. They are Anna Scott Bell, Lily Lin, as well as Jonathan Lin. I also don't want to forget our very important interns as well. So as the fall semester kicks into gear, and if you haven't found an internship already, I invite you to please apply. If not this semester, then the next. So to begin today's program, let's start. So every 5 years, roughly around 2,000 party delegates of the Chinese Communist Party convenes in Beijing for the Party Congress. First, according to experts, the purpose of these party congresses is to establish or set out a party line, update the constitution, and most importantly, to select its senior leaders. Given the opacity of Chinese elite politics, the prelude to every party congress always involved tantalizing developments of officials slated for stardom falling from grace or rising from relative obscurity. The 19th Party Congress is no exception. The leaders who will emerge in the CCP, Politburo, its Standing Committee, and the Central Military Commission are the products of intense internal jockeying for power in the world's largest party state and army, and will have significant consequences on the policies of the People's Republic of China. The highest party official and thus the most powerful person in China is the General Secretary of the CCP. By convention, the General Secretary serves 2 5-year terms for a total of 10, and by that standard, this year marks the midterm of General Secretary Xi Jinping's tenure, who took power in 2012 at the 18th Party Congress. Now, all eyes are set on the 19th Party Congress slated for this fall. If people is a good measure for policy, then the leaders of the all-powerful Politburo, Standing Committee, and Politburo offer material signals into the direction of how PRC policy will be conducted for at least the next 5 years. And many of the members of the current Politburo, as well as Central Military Commission, are set to retire. Arguably, nowhere could the impact of a shift in the current approach on policy be greater felt than in the case of the PRC's policy towards Taiwan. The CCP General Secretary wields enormous power and could, theoretically, end the state of hostility across the Taiwan Strait by deciding to renounce the use of force and make peace with Taiwan. Perhaps more practically and more immediately, though, he could and should end the current stalemate in the freeze of high-level governmental dialogue with Taipei. On the other hand, he could tighten his grip and allow the military brass to dictate an even more heavy-handed and belligerent posture against Taiwan. Under the CCP, the General Secretary chairs an intra-party, inter-agency policy-setting process through a leading small group called the Taiwan Affairs Leading Small Group that's comprised of top-level party, state, and military officials responsible for Taiwan. Membership in this body varied from administration to administration, suggesting that the composition may be seen as a power balance in revealing the strategic focus of the administration's policy towards Taiwan. For instance, retired General Xiong Guangtai, a veteran of Chinese military intelligence, was once the leading small group secretary general and served as a member of this leading small group during the third Taiwan Strait crisis, in which the PLA lobbed missiles towards Taiwan to intimidate Taiwanese voters from electing their preferred candidate. Xiong was known to have advocated and was quite successful in securing a greater role for the military in Taiwan policy. With the 19th Party Congress occurring this fall, which in part served as a report card of Xi's first term, and with the recently concluded annual retreat at Beidaihe, what might we glean from how the makeup of the forthcoming Politburo tell us, in effect, how the Xi Jinping administration will approach Taiwan in the remainder of his administration? Now, there are intense speculations in the Japanese media that Xi's anti-corruption maestro, Wang Qishan, may not be in the lineup for the Politburo after the 19th Party Congress, and that Xi loyalists, Sun Ming'er, who will get an extraordinary promotion that will see him leapfrog from the Central Committee into the Politburo Standing Committee. Furthermore, the confirmation that former commander of the PLA ground force, General Li Zuochen, will replace General Fang Fenghui as chief of the Joint Staff Department at the Central Military Commission, all could have bearings in terms of how China approaches Taiwan. It offers a kaleidoscope of different possibilities in terms of how the policies of China going forward. We're in for a very special treat today, because we have really assembled a truly excellent group of experts who really know the in and outs of the CCP and the PLA to help us give a better sense of the probable, to discern from the probable from the possible. To my immediate left, we have Scott Harrell. Scott is the Associate Director of the Center for Asia-Pacific Policy and a political scientist at the nonprofit Nonpartisan RAND Corporation, as well as a member of the Party RAND Graduate School faculty. To his left, we have Richard McGregor. Richard McGregor is a renowned journalist who served as the Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times from 2011 to 2014. He is the author of The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers, which was awarded the third annual Bernard Schwartz Prize by the Asian Society in New York. He's also the author of a forthcoming book on China, Japan, and the United States. And we're really eagerly anticipating the release of that book so that we can host him here at GTI to have a discussion about it. Last but not least, we have Christopher Johnson, who is a senior advisor and holds a Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS. Chris is an accomplished Asian affairs specialist, no stranger to the people in this room. Mr. Johnson spent nearly two decades serving in the U.S. government's intelligence and foreign affairs community and has extensive experience in analyzing and working in Asia on diverse set of country-specific and transnational issues. He has frequently advised senior White House, cabinet, congressional, military, and foreign officials on the Chinese leadership and on Beijing's foreign and security policies. So let's begin. In keeping with our format of our discussions in the past, I prepared a series of questions that I'll ask each of the speakers. I ask that the speakers are free to weigh in on the questions that are directed at the other speakers, and we'll reserve about 15 minutes at the end of the discussion for audience Q&A. So, Richard, I'd like to start with you. You argued in your seminal 2010 book, The Party, that the modern Chinese state still runs on Soviet hardware. What may we infer in that observation about the role of the Chinese Communist Party in the policymaking process within the PRC, and particularly as it pertains to Taiwan?
Thanks, Russell, and thanks for having me here. If you see me peeking at my mobile phone, that was because I got the time wrong for this event and I didn't print out my notes, and so I'm looking at my Dropbox. And I might even struggle to read that, actually. But look, the role of the party, I don't think there's any much doubt that the role of the party, and certainly the party secretary, Xi Jinping, has strengthened remarkably since he took over in 2012. We've got weak ministries, perhaps the weakest state council for a long, long time. A much stronger role for the particular members of the Politburo Standing Committee in party positions, such as Wang Qishan in the Anti-Corruption Bureau. I think we've also seen that sort of tougher line, more central control and tougher line extend to Taiwan policy as well. If you look at the statements out of the head of the Taiwan Affairs Office, Mr. Zhang, and this is where I might read my notes because I wanted to get his words exactly right, he's really stopped talking about or paying lip service even to giving much room for or taking much note of Taiwan's distinctive, you know, quote-unquote democratic system. He talks openly now about how the one country, two systems idea should be applied to Taiwan just as it's been applied to Hong Kong, and we all see where that what's happened there. To use his phrase, he says Beijing should seek a spiritual matching between the peoples of the two sides of the strait to strengthen solidarity and enable cohesion and the materialization of long-term stability. And he also said that means there should be the proper handling of the systemic and ideological differences between the two sides of the strait after reunification. In other words, it will be the CCP in control in Taipei, should there be unification on whatever terms, and not even, I think, the room that Hong Kong was initially given after 1997. Now, part of that, I guess, might be, you know, cyclical change. We have a DPP government in Taipei, not a KMT government. Obviously, the CCP's attitude to the KMT is very, DPP is very different to that of the KMT. I certainly remembered in the course of the research for my new book about how Deng Xiaoping had talked about how reunification, the sooner the better. In other words, when people from the CCP and the KMT, who not only fought against each other but worked together, could get together and do a deal. And of course, those days are over now. So in that respect, there's both a cyclical change in Beijing's policy, but I think there's also a secular change. In other words, a general toughening up. And just finally, and I won't go into a great deal on the military side, which I'm not an expert on, and I think Scott is going to talk more about. But it's certainly true, and this applies to Chinese foreign policy, particularly in the Asia Pacific more generally. You know, China's capabilities, military capabilities, are much greater now. Xi Jinping took over a much stronger country than Hu Jintao did in 2002. And if your capabilities are stronger, I think you've got much more willingness to take a coercive position rather than a seductive or pseudo-seductive one.
You know, Richard, that's great. And I'd like to stick with you because you brought up the sort of distinction between cyclical and secular differences in terms of how the party has approached its policymaking. And so given the obvious importance of Taiwan for the CCP, the issue, as is seen from Beijing's perspective, has always been managed at a very high level. And leadership transition serves as an indicator of such changes. And so what has or hasn't changed in how the leadership, the leadership transitions approach Taiwan policy? Is this transition that we're approaching right now unprecedented, or are there parallels from the past that we can draw from to infer what the future may have in store?
I don't know that I see distinct parallels. I certainly think that Hu Jintao, that Jiang Zemin had after 1996 and what he would have considered to have been a humiliation in the wake of the shelling near the Taiwan Straits, that there was an element of the clock ticking on Beijing's demands for unification. I think Hu Jintao managed through various devious ways to wind that back. We do have, of course, the first of a number of anniversaries coming up for the CCP, notably 2021, the 100th anniversary of the founding of the party in Shanghai. I still don't see how it works in Beijing's interests at all to set a deadline. But if there were to be a nice gift-wrapped present for 2021, then I think there's no better one than taking Taiwan. I guess in terms of transition, another point as well is that just how quickly Beijing could overwhelm Taiwan militarily as well. And I think that's certainly a much different calculus now than it was 5 years ago.
Thanks for that. Chris, I'd like to move to you. It was expected when it was known that Xi Jinping was going to take over after Hu Jintao, that given Xi's experience as with businessmen and from Taiwan and Fujian and Zhejiang, people consider him to sort of be part of this Zitaipai or sort of no Taiwan faction, suggesting that maybe perhaps that he would adopt a softer approach to Taiwan than his predecessors. However, this has clearly not been the case. You have done a lot of thorough analysis on Xi Jinping. What do you think accounts for the position that Xi has taken on Taiwan?
Great, thanks. And let me just add my thanks for the invitation to come talk today. I think, you know, first and foremost, like so many narratives that were around about Xi Jinping at the time of his appointment, it was just wrong that that he was part of this grouping and had these mindsets. Just like it was wrong that he was a sexier Hu Jintao, just like it was wrong that he was turning left to turn right. You know, there's a whole series of these narratives. I don't know where any of them came from, but they were wrong, and they are wrong, and are still wrong. So, you know, that's a very important point. So, taking from that, then, what does it mean? I don't then consider it a surprise that he's adopted the policy that he has, number one. Number two, I think we'll discuss this a little bit later, but I don't see this as pressure from the PLA, pressure from Jiang Zemin, pressure from pick your constituency, that, you know, if Xi were left to his own devices, indeed he would pursue this softer policy just like Hu Jintao did, but there are, quote, invisible hardliners who are pressuring him. No, this is what he believes, and I think that's what you have to sort of take as this jumping off point. You know, folks that I've spoken to who are very close to his circle say, you know, if you want to know what Xi Jinping thinks about any issue under the sun, look at what he says about it first. That's what he really means. What comes next can be glossing and backtracking and so on. And so what did he say first on this issue? This can't be passed to another generation. So, and I think, you know, does that mean he wants to invade Taiwan? No, it doesn't. But I think that he's setting that policy sort of stance very, very clearly. And as Richard was pointing out, I think we're seeing probably the most feckless Guo Taiban that we've seen in, you know, a long time. The last time they had any independence, I would argue, was under Wang Yi, you know, where there was some interesting thinking and so on going on. Jiang seems to just kind of go with the party line, and I think that's going to continue. I guess my question is, like so many things related to Xi, once we're past all the smoke and mirrors of the party congress and it's done and we've all digested the results, you know, what's he going to do next? And, you know, having gotten that out of the way, presumably, it will free up bandwidth for these issues. And so I think we're going to see a return to the foreign policy vision that he set out at the Foreign Affairs Work Conference in 2014, where he sketched out a very interesting framework, but then kind of turned it over to the MFA to do something with, and they haven't done anything with it. I think Taiwan policy also, you know, holds a lot of potential for change. And I don't know the answer as to which direction he's going to go, but it's not a soft approach, that much I can tell you.
And pulling on that thread a little bit, you know, and on the on your assessment that, you know, the actions taken by Xi's administration reflects, you know, Xi's personal belief and approach to Taiwan policy, there has been a prominent China analyst in Taiwan argued, and I just returned from Taiwan from a business trip that we were there to hold a joint conference with the Taiwan think tank there. Argue that the risky behavior undertaken by Xi in the past few years indicate that he is not necessarily consolidating control, but reflects more of a continuous power struggle that has been ongoing since 18th Party Congress. And you touched on this in part already in your response, but can you give us a more deeper dive in terms of whether or not you agree with this assessment? Yeah. What might either scenario mean in terms of how Xi will approach Taiwan during his second term?
Sure. You know, I think the core of it is to look at the relationship with the military, which obviously is very important in this process. And, you know, if we look at the 95-96 Taiwan Straits crisis, it is very clear that senior military officers and the persons of Liu Huaqing and Jiang Zemin basically told Jiang Zemin what they were going to do in response to provocation by Li Donghui. And he got out in front of them and complied, you know, and that made sense. Likewise, during the Hu Jintao period, there was a lot of talk in the China watching community about a rogue PLA and, you know, out of civilian control and all this. That was all nonsense. But I think what the military did do was to take advantage of certain core, let's call it monopolies, that they have inside the system to create a nice big gray zone for themselves within which to operate on broad foreign and security policy issues. I think some of this is to be expected because the PLA is modernizing and professionalizing, and professional institutions care about things that touch on their corporate interests, so some of that is natural. But I think the difference was that At the end of the day, they have a monopoly on military technical expertise. There is no RAND, there is no CSIS, there is no civilian institution in the Chinese system that provides such advice to their leaders. They have a monopoly on intelligence in a lot of ways. Certainly, you mentioned Chiang Kai-shek, you know, when he was running the show, that was very much happening inside their system. Three, I think they have a sort of knowledge, a sort of monopoly on, forces and gear, right? You know, there's no civilian expertise in this space either. So they created this sort of very comfy gray zone for themselves. What has Xi Jinping done since he arrived? He's been substantially decreasing that gray zone, shrinking it down a lot. And you cannot separate anti-corruption in the military and force restructuring, which I think are the, you know, 1-2 punch of neutering the PLA out of that equation. And so, as such, I just don't believe that they are off on their own pressuring him to take a hard line on Taiwan. He takes a hard line because he wants a hard line.
Well, that's an excellent segue. Moving to you, Scott. What is the role of the PLA in the PRC's Taiwan policymaking apparatus?
Yeah, sure. First, please, Russell, allow me to say what a pleasure it is to return to GTI and to thank you and your team for the excellent job you all have been doing in highlighting and informing the world, Washington, and me, least importantly, of Taiwan's importance and role in the world. And it's also an enormous pleasure to be on the stage with these gentlemen who I always learn so much from. What's the role of the PRC in Taiwan's policy? I think, first off, it's important to recognize that the PLA is one tool among many that the PRC has in its ambitions to try to absorb Taiwan. Far more consequential, I think, in everyday terms, are the economic, diplomatic, and informational tools that China uses to try to cut Taiwan off, isolate it, disincentivize other countries from cooperating with Taiwan, marginalize Taiwan, and craft a narrative that delegitimates the very existence of Taiwan as an independent country that's democratic and liberal, and construct it instead as a historical entity that has briefly and in an aberrant way somehow managed to separate from China, but will ultimately be reabsorbed. With that said, Chris has already highlighted some of the really important elements here. The PLA does have an important role in kind of providing psychological warfare angles, United Front capabilities. They do obviously have a lot of the cyber intrusion tools that allow Taiwan to be penetrated, and ultimately intimidation and war fighting if the Chinese leadership decides that they, for whatever reason, have ultimately have to try to attack Taiwan. As with many other aspects of how decisions get made in China, decisions on sensitive policy questions with respect to Taiwan are something of a black box. Chris is quite good at reading it, so is Richard, but my sense is that, you know, within the Taiwan Affairs Leading Small Group, the PLA has a voice, together with the Taiwan Affairs Office and other bodies. And ultimately, remember, Xi Jinping is a part of the PLA. He's the commander-in-chief of the PLA, so ultimately the PLA, in some, you know, definitional sense, has the ultimate say. But let's talk about institutional PLA as opposed to people who have many hats like Xi Jinping. I think Chris has really correctly noted, in areas of core competency, as well as by dint of the fact that they actually have the hardware that would be necessary, the PLA has the ability to shape outcomes, most in areas where they have responsibility and an informational advantage. Just to add a slight note, I completely agree with Chris that the notion that the PLA was a complete rogue is nonsense, but I do think that the consensus analysis on why the Xi administration has pursued reform of the PLA has highlighted that there were roguish portions of the PLA that were not under his control and were perceived to be operating with too great a divergence from the central leadership's ultimate control, corruption being a form of divergence because it introduces perverse incentives. So for several decades and down to the present day, I think the Taiwan conflict scenario has been the primary driver for the PLA's modernization efforts. And that is everything from their attempts to engage in what they would term as active defense or local limited wars under conditions of informationalization. In other words, the need to be able to defeat the Republic of China or Taiwan's armed forces, as well as any intervening forces from the United States and or Japan. And in that sense, it might be fair to say that Taiwan has played a major role in the PLA's modernization, just as much as the PLA plays a role in trying to shape Taiwan policy.
And you just touched on this also briefly in your initial comments, but I'd like to stick with you here, Scott, and that is, and taken in context with Xi's trademark anti-corruption drive, which Chris also addressed, which is turn the PLA on its head. You know, how much influence does and will the PLA have in influencing Taiwan policy going forward?
Yeah, so it's an excellent question, and I want to rephrase it, if I could, Russell, just to say, you know, how much influence or how has the anti-corruption drive affected the PLA's role? I think it's unclear that the anti-corruption drive has affected the PLA's role negatively in terms of their ability to generate military power. In fact, in some sense, it's probably cut out some of the dead weight that was much more interested in enriching itself, buying up gold bars, building excess houses, having mistresses. If anything, it's probably cleared away some of the opposition to PLA reform. And so PLA reform, let's talk about briefly, since this is extremely relevant for Taiwan's security. It has been the case that the PLA has eliminated the four general departments that previously were dominated by the ground forces and were used to effectively run the PLA as an organization. What that means to those of you who don't spend all of your time thinking about military affairs is the army, the ground forces, the least competent at projecting power over distances and in complicated environments, have seen their power reduced. That means correspondingly that forces like the Air Force, the Navy, the what used to be the 2nd Artillery and has now been renamed the PLA Rocket Force and upgraded to the service, are now having much greater ability to influence and shape debates within the Central Military Commission. Additionally, the PLA reforms have established a new strategic support force that's dedicated to the execution of what the PLA refers to as integrated network and electronic warfare, or more broadly put, information operations that include psychological operations and united front warfare, as well as cyber intrusion. So these things help the PLA project power. Additionally, they've reshaped the way in which the PLA actually commands and controls its forces by standing up these new theater war commands and then turning the services into force providers for commanders who will then direct the forces. This improves the ability of the PLA to generate and command power over distances and over time, because previously the services had an ambiguous relationship where you might actually have had military region commander receiving orders from a service commander in Beijing and then having to navigate to deal with other service commanders and try to figure that out in a complicated war environment. Now you have something much closer to the unified combatant command structure in the United States military, where you have commanders who command forces being provided by services. The goal of the reforms has been to create a more integrated joint force that's capable of fighting and winning wars, to use Xi Jinping's phrase, and to do that under the disciplined and efficient control of the new commander-in-chief, which is a new title that Xi Jinping has taken on. I think for Taiwan, this suggests that the reforms probably put us somewhere in the early to middle stages of a roughly 3 to 5 year time frame for China working through the challenges of how these new operational and command and control relationships work. That means it's time for Taiwan to be very aggressively advancing a form of anti-access and area denial warfare grounded in an all-of-society approach that works also with neighboring countries and the United States, to generate an approach to armed conflict that will make it impossible for the PLA to credibly claim to Xi Jinping they can definitely guarantee victory at anything like an acceptable cost. Finally, in addition to CSIS, RAND and CSBA and other analysts and institutions have done excellent work on how the Republic of China's armed forces could produce a more lethal, network, survivable, and resilient defense concept. And I hope that the Tsai administration can quickly move to adjust Taiwan's defense policy in that direction to reduce vulnerabilities and increase the prospects of effective deterrence and resolute defense, whereas the new administration now prefers multiple deterrence and resolute defense.
Thanks, Scott.
Russell, before we move on, because mm-hmm. Scott mentioned something that I think is super important, and I won't go into depth now, but we should touch on it. You know, the other aspect here, and you asked about what's different about Xi Jinping and his approach and so on, the United Front Work Department is playing a bigger role now than it has in many decades. Its budget is way up, its staffing size is way up. And this is, I think, part and parcel of what Richard described as the partification of the party. But that is huge, and it's not restricted to Taiwan. We see this activity in Australia, lots of coverage of that. They're doing it here too. They're just not as aggressive, but they will be someday. You know, they see places like Australia or Taiwan as more passive environments where they can, you know, test out these operational concepts before deploying them elsewhere. So that's a whole new piece that's really relevant. You know, it's not clear to me whether the decision to, after Li Jinghua was purged, to make the United Front Work Department director a Politburo member again was simply convenient personnel moving by Xi Jinping to open up, you know, Tianjin at the time, or whether we will see that same person be on the Politburo next time. My gut is it's the latter, but that's a very important development.
And since Chris called you out, Richard, I'm gonna direct my next question to you, is that the CCP has demonstrated a high degree of flexibility on matters of, this is shifting gear a little bit, but matters of economic policy, but it's been fiercely rigid in its political control. You wrote that, quote, the system has also provided, proved to be flexible and protean enough to absorb everything that has been thrown at it, end quote. Something that it hoped but could not thus far absorb is Taiwan. Why do you think it has been incapable of adapting to, perhaps, quote, objective reality as it concerns Taiwan?
Yeah, well, that's a very difficult question. I mean, as Chris said, the United Front Department is more active than ever, but of course that means we've got a number of ominous trends, contradictory trends. I think it's no secret to people in this room that the sentiment for reunification in China is probably weaker than ever. I'm not sure whether I'm correct, but I think the last polls had it a strong sense of reunification at about 10%. It may be even less with younger people. It was quite striking for me when I was there last year talking to the leaders of the new power party, I think I've got the name right, they don't even think about reunification. It's not even something they discuss and say yes or no. It's not even on their agenda. So in some respects, no matter what sort of political resources China throws at Taiwan to seduce it, there's nothing left to seduce. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, of course, I think Taiwan has a strong democratic culture, but it's much weaker as a nation or a country or as an entity, however you want to describe it. It no longer has a technological advantage over China, which it once did. It no longer has an economic advantage over China. It's just another market. I think the one area where China has been successful, and this is a sort of an offshoot of United Front or Party activities or policy generally, is to weaken the government in Taipei, no matter which party is in power. You have a lot of very talented, intelligent individuals in the government and bureaucracy in Taiwan, like you would have in any country, but they're restricted in what they can even do and what they can think about. You know, there's an obsessive discussion, will China let us go to the ILO this year? Can we sort of have observer status at this institution or that institution? And that degrades governing capacity in China. And so you've got, it's a Freudian slip or not. So has China has been effective on one level, but utterly ineffective on another level. And I think in a very broad sense, it goes to show that, you know, the Communist Party's great failure is, and this doesn't just apply to Taiwan, is the ability to seduce adversaries. It's much more about coercion. I can give you one example of seduction, which is the Asia Infrastructure Bank or something like that, but that's actually a great political success, but a tiny institution. And I think that failure applies to Taiwan. And it's very hard to know how that has worked out in the end, because there's no sense that I can see that the party in power in China will make a fundamental change of policy.
You know, you made I like to stick with you, Richard, really quickly, because you made one comment about a very interesting observation, an important observation about the sort of the sentiments in Taiwan for unification. Now, what do you think it means in terms of how China will approach Taiwan? Does it think that time is on its side? Is time not on its side? And how would this, in your sense, what do you think? How would this impact?
There used to be a school of thought, I think, that said time was on their side. I think that is a school of thought in China. I think it's much smaller now. And the proof is in the pudding, because it's been a long, long time, and Taiwan has just, emotionally, psychologically, politically, just continued to drift away. I can remember, talking to the renowned hawk Yan Xuetong about 10 years ago, and he said, Taiwan's gone, we've lost it. We should just give up on our current approach, and I suspect that was not a majority view then, but it's probably a much more popular and well-founded view now.
Can I just make one brief comment on whether or not Taiwan's time is on Taiwan's side or China's side? I think it's important to disaggregate that. along numerous axes, right? So okay. Chris noted, Richard noted that previously Taiwan was more important economically, Taiwan had a technological military advantage. In those areas, Taiwan is on the wrong side of the time equation. In the future, China will only get, probably in the future, China will enjoy an even more dominant military advantage over Taiwan. Probably in the future, China as an economy will grow even more important than Taiwan. But in the emotional, national identity space, in the global norms space, maybe. But certainly in the interior Taiwan identity metric, by that metric, China is certainly running against China. So I just think it helps to disaggregate this and to see that what that means, I think, is that China is feeling, probably, that it's pushed more and more into the coercion side and has far fewer attractive or even plausible options on the trick you, fool you, win you over, play the hearts and minds, seduce you side of the equation.
And that's great analysis there. And I think, turning to you, Chris, some analysts believe that the Taiwan Strait may be entering another sort of crisis point. And like, for instance, the 1996 Taiwan Strait crisis. Do you see any parallels in terms of what was leading up to the 1996 crisis to where we are headed to now?
I'm sure there are some parallels. I guess to me the stark differences, though, are much more prominent in my mind, especially when you have a look at to what both Richard and Scott have said. You know, I covered the 95-96 Taiwan Strait crisis when I was in the government, and as concerned as we were about that situation, and it was a serious situation, at the end of the day, that was a made-for-TV movie by the PLA, to try to sort of, shock Taiwan into submission. They have those capabilities now, and they don't talk about them, because there's no made-for-TV movie, because now they can execute on those missions. And that's a seminal difference. I think, in terms of crisis, what's been interesting to me, to come at it from kind of a slightly different perspective, is in the same way that when thinking about, say, the South China Sea or the East China Sea, we cannot look at those situations in a vacuum. In other words, we have to understand them in terms of China's broad, very broad and integrated maritime strategy. I think Taiwan is also cannot be viewed in singularity. And so if you look at the 95-96 crisis, I mean, what was one of the major outcomes? It was a decision by the Politburo at the time that Taiwan is existential for us, and therefore we must focus like a laser beam on dealing with this problem. And South China Sea and these other issues kind of go into the background, right? And we'll pay a price, but it'll be a manageable one. Well, 12 years later, when Ma Ying-jeou shows up and they can finally look around again, they realize they've played a very big price, and they've then put their thumb very heavily on the balance scale to try to readdress that. One interesting thing that I find curious and as an intellectual exercise is clearly at that time in 95-96, they decided we cannot walk and chew gum at the same time. We cannot have two fronts going on. With modernization, their own sense of their growing power, frankly, their assessment of where we're sitting these days, maybe they could think they could walk and chew gum at the same time. So that's something to watch very carefully. And then just to add on, I think the most signal difference between the two periods is, as Richard has sort of touched on, China's coercive toolkit, let's call it, over Taiwan is so much more varied and sophisticated now than it was at that time. All they had then was the military hammer. Now they've got the economic piece, information warfare, global positioning, you name it. And it's a much subtler toolkit, but just as bad or worse.
I was going just to add to that on the military talk piece, and I think I've been in a forum where Scott might have heard this discussed before as well. I think the general rule of thumb for the Chinese military taking over Taiwan has generally been 30 days. I saw an extensive discussion about 6 months ago where some good analysts here said that China could do it in a single day. Let's place the flag over Taipei. I don't know whether that's a consensus view or not, but there's no doubt their coercive abilities have come a long way.
you know, Chris and Richard have both weighed in on this, but I want to get your thoughts, Scott. You know, really, what is your assessment in terms of the sort of evolution of the PLA's approach or the toolkit, if you may also, towards Taiwan?
I mean, I think that, you know, undeniably, if you look back 15, 20, let's say 22 years to the mid-1990s, you know, back then Taiwan was a problem that the PLA could solve with only one option, and that was punishment, but not actual conquering Taiwan, and the only real tool that they had was cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. The Second Artillery Force was really the only option. I think the PLA Air Force, the PLA Navy didn't really have the capacity to do much. The PLA Army wasn't really positioned. Today, if commanded to do so, the PLA would have the means to deliver not only air-launched and missile-delivered munitions packages against key point targets in Taiwan, but could also attack it from the sea, including from the east, could contest, at least for some period of time until probably achieving dominance, the airspace over Taiwan. It could certainly deliver at least tens of thousands of amphibious assault forces towards Taiwan. Those would be, the beachfront would be a major battle, but it's one that Taiwan needs to recognize. China is working very diligently to try to master, including by acquiring landing craft that can move very quickly over open water. China would be able to degrade at least Taiwan's electronic command and control capabilities. It would certainly attack the island from inside using forces in place, saboteurs, agents provocateurs, and probably insert special operations forces. So these are all capabilities that have changed dramatically over the last 20 years. I think key challenges remain for the PLA. Those would include sea and airlift to deliver forces. Submarine and anti-submarine warfare would continue to be a challenge for them, but it's one, again, that they're working on very hard. And they don't yet have, I think, confidence in their missile defenses against Taiwan's own air-launched and truck-launched anti-ship cruise missiles and short-range surface-to-surface missiles, ballistic missiles. But again, these are areas where the PLA is trying to improve itself. They're working very hard at training, and increasingly their training is realistic, unscripted, and they're regularly going into spaces where they would potentially have to fight. And that's hugely consequential, because on game day, you don't want to show up and say, I've never been on this field before. I've never actually been in the waters east of Taiwan before. You want to say, no, we were there 2 months ago. And by the way, we may be there a week beforehand, and we say it's an exercise, and we've done exercises dozens of times. And so exercises and regular routine transits in international waters, which are, you know, legal, no one can object to, but they can serve as an excellent cover for routinizing China's plans to actually execute an attack. And that can really blur or hamper the acquisition of indicators and warnings about an impending attack. So I think that's really the challenge for Taiwan now, is that while Taiwan has been modernizing elements of its force, Beijing has been modernizing almost all of the elements of its capability.
That's an excellent point, Scott. And I think I'll just point out in just today's Global Taiwan Brief, you know, we had, when we were in Taipei, a senior Taiwan government official confirmed that the PLA has stepped up military exercises around Taiwan's AIDS to now, in just this year alone, there have been 14 aerial exercises, wherein in 2015 to 2016 there had only been a total of 8. And so this is a very substantial increase in the number of exercises that Air Force is undertaking. This, of course, taken in conjunction with the number of this has been the increase of naval exercises that has been ongoing for at least the past, you know, decade. Just like to point that out as a fact. The last remaining questions is for the group as a whole, and then we'll move to audience Q&A. And what I'd like to do in this sort of interest of time is sort of combine these questions, and so that it gives us more time for what I'm sure will be very informed and good questions. So. There has been and continues to be a common refrain that that we often hear in Washington's Taiwan and China watching community, that Xi's action has been constrained due to the sensitivities of the ongoing of the upcoming 19th Party Congress, and that it would be able to, he would be able to then focus more on Taiwan afterwards. So, you know, really, sort of, what are and if any implications of this sort of this change, the shift, if there is one, will it have in terms of, you know, what might be in store for us after the 19th Party Congress? Whoever would like to take that first.
In some ways it's easy, you know, it's just, I don't know.
Look into your the crystal ball, please.
Yeah. I think Chris said earlier that, I think it's first going to be interesting to see what actually happens at the party congress. And you don't want to make a fool of yourself by making solid predictions about that. Chris had an interesting piece recently about debating whether this issue about whether China really, or the Communist Party really had an evolving set of institutional norms governing leadership change or governing sort of a positional change generally within the party and at all levels of the party. And I don't want to sort of summarize his conclusion. He might disagree with it, but it's basically, well, China had norms until it didn't. Certainly whatever has happened, whatever will happen, that Xi Jinping has laid the groundwork to do what he wants, if he can, at the party congress. It still seems to me after that that he just can't, one of the mysteries is Xi Jinping is already meant to be one of the most powerful Chinese leader since Deng. He only has, in theory, and I don't want to get into a sort of binary factional analysis of Chinese politics, but in theory he's only got two loyalists on the seven-member Politburo Standing Committee. So if he's already the most powerful person, what does he want to do that he can't already do? And that's not clear to me, actually. And I think, yes, there would be more focus on Taiwan, but no matter how strong their military is, their options are not great.
Just a quick comment. I think Chris said it very well earlier, but the notion that the PLA is somehow forcing any of these issues, it implies at least that Xi Jinping would prefer to go a different path. But I don't think we've ever seen, at least since maybe the mid to late 90s, if you're really generous, anything approaching a liberal or pseudo or soft line within the top leadership of the Politburo Standing Committee in terms of any single member. Maybe somebody would want to try to trot out Wen Jiabao, I don't know. But I mean, realistically, none of these people are not, in their view, patriots and something akin to hawkish or at least strong. And so I just don't think that it behooves us. I mean, I think if you want to understand who is Xi Jinping, look at his speech in Mexico where he groused about, foreigners with full bellies with nothing better to do than to point at us. And look at his comments about, the CPSU, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, how nobody had the balls to stand up, but, implying that Xi Jinping would, if it came to it, send in the tanks or use force to really pursue China's views aggressively. And I think if you look at the China dream, the great national rejuvenation of China, I mean, this is a, to use American terms, a blood and soil fascist dream. We have those here. And that is what this dream represents, is the ultimate forcible, if necessary, absorption of Taiwan. I don't think it's a dream that in any way is derived from advice he's getting from the PLA, in large measure because he's purged most of the people who in the PLA could have opposed him. So if people in the PLA are imposing this on Xi Jinping, how is it that they're not getting purged too? I just think it's useful to bear in mind. This is an individual who I think is very comfortable wearing the reins of power. It feels that it's his mission to preserve the CCP and to expand its influence, and feels like he has the political wherewithal to do so and to push forward, and that it's what the CCP itself wants him to do or needs him to do if it's going to survive. It's kind of a return to late 1980s neo-authoritarianism. We actually have never heard that term trotted out, to the best of my knowledge, but it's very much a discussion that was in vogue almost 30 years ago and seems to be reaching its realization.
I'll try to be super brief so we can get to the audience. I mean, I think primarily, I guess, the two things. One, the point of the piece I wrote that Richard referred to was to simply lay out what I believe is Xi Jinping's personnel logic. I made a really serious attempt not to make any predictions, but just to try to lay out, here's how he's probably thinking about things. And we don't know the answers. I think everything that's out there that I've seen post-Bei Daihe is all noise and no signal. We have to kind of see how that shakes out. But I think the broader issue is Xi has definitely created a new ecosystem inside this institution. And the rest of the Politburo Standing Committee members, as Richard kind of pointed out, don't really matter. There's two or three people in there that really matter. The rest of them are holdovers who, from what I can tell, I mean, what is Zhang Gaoli's view on Taiwan or on any issue? What is Yu Jiangcheng's view on this matter? We don't know. And maybe it's just they have strong views and they're very influential in these debates, but we just don't know. That's certainly possible. You know, what it means for Taiwan, I think, is unclear, but what we can say is if he has a big victory, which it looks very likely he will, then whatever his views on the matter are going to continue to, you know, rule the day. And I think certainly what we see is an impression that he does not trust the Tsai administration, and he never will. And he sees them as, you know, hardcore independence activists, and that view is not going to change. And so then, you know, we should expect, I think, more of the same that we've been seeing, and maybe an intensified version here.
Thank you very much. Okay, so now we have about 10 minutes for audience Q&A. So please state your name as well as your affiliation, and please try to keep your questions brief and direct. Michael?
Thanks very much for a very rich panel. I'm Mike Fonte. I'm the director of the DPP's mission here. I was just in Taiwan, and I want to just assure everybody that the sense of urgency that you've all talked about is very real. The message, that was the message I brought, that the U.S. feels a concern that Taiwan hasn't developed the kind of response, deterrent response that Scott kind of mentioned briefly. And they're moving very quickly, I think, to move in that direction. They understand the urgency. Whether they can get up to speed is a whole other question, but another thing that happened while I was there was a scenario where the presidential palace was kind of under attack. And I think that brought, I know, Tsai Ing-wen told me, brought her into sharp focus, the potential from internal questions that you've all raised, United Front, etc. So I think the message has been received, and there's really an attempt by Taiwan to put it forward. I guess the question is, we hear in our conversations here this three-year urgency period. You have to get it over or else. And I guess we've had mixed messages here. Could you speak a little bit more to that? Do you see Xi Jinping, should he get all the power we expect him to in the 19th Party Congress, moving that direction? Obviously, there are many views on that.
I'll just say I don't think so. I don't see him returning to the timeline, if you will, for a series of reasons, perhaps the most prominent of which is, why tell your enemy what you're going to do?
Yeah, I hate being on these, hate watching panels where people agree with each other, but I actually agree with that.
Okay, I'll just say very quickly, Mike, you know, I'm glad that Dr. Tsai, President Tsai, feels the personal urgency, because it's an attack that was intended to be directed at her. But frankly, you know, Chen Shui-bian got shot, so did Netlu. You know, mind you, there was a truck attack on the presidential palace, and Sean Lian, despite being from a different party, was shot. And this political violence inside Taiwan is not a new phenomenon. I grant that when it happens directed at you, it should focus your mind, but this shouldn't be something new. It's clear the administration definitely has no room at all to downplay this, and I hope that they are pushing as aggressively as you can, because the threat is, I think, as real as it could be. As to whether or not we're on a 3 or 5 year timeline, I think that one of the real challenges for Xi Jinping is going to be, if he does want to extend beyond 2022, one of the questions that he will face is there something he can point to justify that? I mean, it's certainly possible that he can say, who's the person who's going to stand up and say, boss, great run for two cycles, but we've got this rule, 10 years, you got to go, next person's coming in. That seems completely implausible. Nonetheless, he may still want to justify it. If the DPP wins again in 2020, and it doesn't appear that in 2024 the KMT could ever come back, that might be a pressing point that he could say in 2022, we've got to do something because I can't exit with my rival saying, hey, wait a minute, you've lost Taiwan in perpetuity.
Yeah. Hi, Leo Bosner, Kokushikan University. With regard to the military, the Chinese idea of a military incursion against Taiwan, assuming it happened and assuming they won, has Beijing thought about what happens afterwards? If we think about the British in Northern Ireland, the Americans in Vietnam, where I was as a soldier, the Russians in Afghanistan, have they really thought that through, what it might be like afterward? Or what do they think it'll be like afterward?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's so obvious, isn't it? It's lose-lose, you know, have an island occupied, even if a lot of people fled from Taiwan, occupying an island of 22 million, 23 million people. People with a great sense of their democratic rights and the like, and people who fought for them. So that's why the military option, no matter how relatively easy or easier it becomes for Beijing, just seems like a lose-lose proposition.
Yeah, just on the, you know, there is an element of the kind of dog chasing car, you know, what are you going to do if you catch it? On the other hand, let's not forget, China has occupied Xinjiang, Tibet, Hong Kong, and Macau. There was resistance in all of those, not necessarily armed, certainly not at the level that Taiwan could put up. But that hasn't deterred China and the Communist Party from thinking that if it wants it, it will go after it. And ultimately, it will find people who will collaborate, or it will put people in there physically who are already on their side and weed out those who are opposed to it. And the unfortunate reality is sometimes countries do conquer other countries. It doesn't happen often in modern history, but it has happened. And countries do annex other countries' territories. And so I don't think that we should think that, well, you know, they've got no plan for it and that we know about at the public level. And they look at how hard it would be. I think North Korea is another example of a country that also aspires to forcibly annex its neighbor. And I don't think that they're going to be deterred by the fact that, oh, it would be difficult. What would we do if we absorbed a country twice our size that's gotten used to having democratic freedoms and is an alliance with the United States? So I just don't think we can. I don't mean to suggest that you think we would feel easy about this, but I think we need to be very concerned that this is not as much of a deterrent as it might be to people sitting in this room thinking, well, that would be crazy. How badly would that go?
Gentleman in the back.
Gregory Ho from Radio Free Asia. This question is to Johnson. What would you expect the outcome of the 19th Party Congress? What will be the most unexpected outcome? If the Central Military Commission is part of the focus, since we know that the Joint Chief of Staff was just recently replaced, the Defense News Network has not announced that piece until we figure out the Joint Chief has been replaced. According to our source, there will be another one, less than 67 years old, that will be replaced soon, and he is from the Hu Jintao's faction. So if we look at the 10 military commission member, it is going to be a full house reshuffle. 7 of the existing member will be replaced, 5 because they are older than 67, but for those less than 67 years old, 2 are 66 years old. Joint Chief of Staff has been replaced. He's not up to that age. So my question is, what will be the most unexpected outcome of the Party Congress? Anything that you see that should happen, and then that's the concrete question that we can expect. Thank you.
Okay, there's a lot in there, so let me try to find the question. But you know, I think the biggest unexpected development will be to expect the unexpected. You know, I think that Xi Jinping may do things that are even more radical than we've even considered in terms of structure and in terms of design. You know, the Central Military Commission's an interesting example because, you know, historically, if we looked at something like the recent replacement of Fang Fenghui, you know, we would say, that's really bizarre. You don't usually do that a month before the Party Congress. But we have a new structure, very conveniently. So old norms don't necessarily apply to analyzing the current situation. I mean, you know, there's some information that says that Fang Fenghui is under investigation. You know, there's other stuff that says he's going to be a vice chairman of the CMC. That tells you how little, you know, we actually know about the situation. And so I think really, you know, something that could just completely come out of left field, there's a lot of speculation about succession and so on. What if they decide to reestablish the party chairmanship and Xi Jinping makes someone else the general secretary? That'd be highly unexpected.
Gentleman in the second to last row in the center.
Stanley Kober. I was a student in the Soviet Union, and one of the things in retrospect that was most important was the attitude of the Soviet students toward the Communist Party. None of them respected it. This was perfectly obvious. Even speaking to me as a foreigner, and I can see this. When I speak to Chinese students here, I'm noticing something similar. I never hear any respect for the Communist Party. And I'm wondering if history could repeat itself. if the fate of the Chinese Communist Party could follow that of the Soviet Communist Party.
You wrote the party.
I must say that doesn't fit with what I know. And there's respect and there's getting on the winning side. And no matter what you think about the party, I mean, I think China as a country has been a success story for 30 years. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. And many students see benefits in joining the party. A very valuable network. I just don't see that. And there's a lot of surveys out these days. Some I think done in conjunction with Pew and the like. I'm not an expert on them, but they turn up surprisingly high levels of popular support, or much higher than you would think for the party. Now, of course, that could go south very quickly if the economy went south. I think the key to everything is the economy in many respects. But my view is many people fear the party. Maybe they don't respect the party in a way of, you know, love and respect. But I think the party's been very effective in getting people, more people than you would have thought on side, particularly post-89.
In the interest of time, I'm going to take the two last questions here in the front, and then we'll have to close for the session.
Hello, thank you. Rita Chen from the Central News Agency. My first question is about the POA's operation. Since we all seem like agree, as Chris mentioned, that there won't be a soft approach to Taiwan by President Xi. I'm just wondering, what should Taiwan prepare for? Should Taiwan change the old volunteer military policy? What's your suggestion? And I want to straightforward for my second question. Will you be surprised if the Xi Jinping take a third turn on the both position? Thank you.
Hi, Garrett van der Weest, former editor of Taiwan Communique. Very excellent panel. But as far as I can see, most of these scenarios are quite negative on how Xi might move. Are there any boundary conditions or any necessary condition for a more positive development where China might say, hey, it is in our own interest to have peaceful coexistence between the two?
I guess the first one was directed at me, so why don't I take a stab at that? You know, as to sort of the PLA's operational plans and how Taiwan should respond, I actually largely defer to Scott because Rand's done excellent work on this. It's basically adopt what a lot of people have been telling the Taiwan government for some time. I mean, you know, my own assessment of the all-volunteer military is that it's a mixed bag because culturally and resource-wise, you know, the government necessarily hasn't done what needs to be done to make that effective. So there's a lot of different ways to analyze that problem. On third term, my own view is it's way too early. He has no reason to make that decision now or even to signal how he's thinking about it. And I'm a bit of an outlier, I think, in the China watching community, but I actually think Xi Jinping would consider it a failure if he has to stay on as party chief for a third term. But that's me.
I'll disagree with Chris, so we finally get something patched up. I would be surprised if Xi Jinping doesn't stay on. I just think that after you've purged your predecessors, closest allies, and put them on alert, it's a risky situation to try to then hand off power yourself and think you could be safe. Granted, we saw this in Russia, to come back to the previous question, where Yeltsin did hand over power to Putin. But remember, it was only Yeltsin and his close family who survived that. All of the oligarchs who were around Yeltsin got rolled up. I just think that the more you make a system like this into as soon as you turn your back, a knife gets planted in it, the harder it is to then ever step away from power. And as I said earlier, I just think Xi Jinping thinks he's born to the throne because he is a red princeling, and he's very, very he's much more comfortable with political power than either of his two predecessors. So I guess that's... I can be wrong. I mean, I actually think that, you know, we should all be making predictions, and it's more about making a prediction and putting your ideas out there. Even if you're wrong, none of us know the future, so we should be bold about that. Boundary conditions for China to be nice, quote-unquote, right? I mean, I do think that one option, it's not one that I'm hoping to see, although I guess maybe if the alternative is outright war, but I suspect that the PRC could decide that if it could really pry away an additional 15 or 20 of Taiwan's countries that extend diplomatic recognition to the Republic of China, Taiwan, that might be enough to say, look, you know, when I inherited it, there was still, you know, a ninth or a tenth of the countries in the world recognized Taiwan. Yes, I have not achieved the absorption of Taiwan, but look, there's three countries left that still recognize Taiwan, and that's good enough for Xi Jinping. That's not a really very happy scenario for anybody to, you know, who likes Taiwan and thinks it should be recognized as a nation or as a, you know, an independent country. But it's probably better than saying, yeah, missiles are raining down and, you know, half of the forces are dead and blah, blah, blah. You know, really terrible situations that we can all play games with and think about. So maybe that's something that China might think about, but it's certainly not one that should make anybody in this room right now. Yes, my suggestion is look at Rand's website. We have actually done work on this question. I will confess that that work came out earlier this summer, and I have not had a chance to read it yet, so I can't summarize it for you. But it is on our website. Thank you.
Richard, do you have any last words?
No. I mean, my sense is that, I mean, we don't know whether he'll have a third term, but I think he'll leave that option open. You know, we don't know what's going to happen in the second five-year term in any case, but I don't have anything more sensible than that.
Well, that brings our session today to a close. Please join me in thanking our panelists today. Also, as a final note, if you aren't already subscribed to receive our updates, please visit our website at www.globaltaiwan.org. Thank